Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm hoping you're enjoying a star-spangled fourth. As we celebrate this holiday, it's natural our thoughts travel to our nation's capital. With the elections ahead, political books are coming fast and furious. I've mentioned Clinton Cash before, but here's an interesting update. The book, which investigates alleged connections between the Clinton Foundation donors and Hillary's work at the State Department, is now undergoing significant revisions after 7 or 8 passages were found to be inaccurate. No shortage of fireworks in D.C. Let's put Washington in the spotlight with notable nonfiction and fiction. Brad Meltzer stops by to chat about his new Washington thriller, The President's Shadow. We have an action-packed agenda, so let's get started as we turn to page 1 of the book report. The Georgetown set is a fascinating behind-the-scenes history of post-war Washington. Author Greg Herkin spotlights the close-knit group of journalists, spies, and government officials who waged the Cold War over cocktails and dinner. In the years after World War II, Georgetown's leafy streets were home to an unlikely group of Cold War warriors, affluent, well-educated, and well-connected civilians who helped steer American strategy from the Marshall Plan through McCarthyism, Vietnam, and Watergate. The set included Phil and Kay Graham, publishers of the Washington Post, Joe and Stuart Alsop, odd couple brothers who were two of the country's premier political pundits, Frank Wisner, a driven, manic, depressive lawyer in charge of the CIA covert operations, and a host of diplomats, spies, and scholars. Lloyd James performs the book.
The president had been informed of possible casualties resulting from such a conflict shortly after assuming office. Classified studies estimated that more than 200 million people, Americans, Russians, and Chinese, might be killed, with additional millions around the world doomed to a lingering death from radioactive fallout. Despite that terrifying prospect, all of Kennedy's guests agreed that he was right in rejecting Khrushchev's ultimatum. Joe Alsop was perhaps most vehement in urging the president to stand firm on Berlin. There was an unspoken element to the near fanatical enmity that Joe held for the Russians. On a visit to Moscow 4 years earlier, Alsop had been ensnared and photographed in a homosexual tryst orchestrated by the KGB. Frank Wisner, Joe's friend and neighbor, and the former head of covert operations for the Central Intelligence Agency, had persuaded Alsop to alert the CIA and the FBI to the Moscow incident, thereby drawing the sting from the KGB's blackmail threat. But the threat nonetheless continued to hang over the journalist, and years later, the incriminating pictures would mysteriously begin showing up in the mailboxes of Alsop's enemies in Washington. Phil Graham, too, had become increasingly critical of the Russians, an attitude evident both in his personal views and in the editorial policy of his newspaper. On June 19th, the Monday evening after the meeting at Glen Ora, the Post publisher met with the two Soviet experts who had advised Kennedy at Vienna, Chip Bolin and Llewellyn Tommy Thompson, America's ambassador to Moscow. Each had told Kennedy that Khrushchev might try to bully him at the summit and had warned the young president against engaging the veteran communist in a political debate. Both believed that if Kennedy stood up to Khrushchev, the Russian would back down. Joe Alsop, Frank Wisner, Chip Bolin, and Tommy Thompson were all Phil Graham's good friends. They were also Graham's neighbors in the exclusive Washington, D.C. enclave of Georgetown, where the men and their wives often gathered on Sunday nights for supper and animated, martini-fueled discussions of world affairs. The meeting on the 19th took place at Bolin's house and went late into the night. On Tuesday morning, Phil Graham called Newsweek's Washington bureau chief, Ben Bradley, into his office at the Post, along with his newspaper's editors and top reporters. Graham let it be known that he and his publishing empire would be on the president's side in the coming showdown with the Russians. "We knew he was actually asking us to write something to promote Kennedy's policies, which was a legitimate news story, but it made us uncomfortable," recalled Chalmers Roberts, the Post's diplomatic correspondent. Over the next several weeks, a multi-part series on the beleaguered bastion of Berlin appeared on the paper's front page. Shortly after the former Vice President Richard Nixon publicly criticized Kennedy for timidity, "Never in American history has a man talked so big and acted so little," Newsweek leaked word that the Pentagon was evacuating U.S. military dependence from West Germany and increasing nuclear readiness. The president himself was suspected of authorizing the leak. The Post's syndicated cartoonist, Herblock, likewise joined in the anti-Khrushchev campaign. Also, too, beat the drum for Kennedy without ever mentioning the evening spent at Glen Ora. By mid-July, Joe had devoted no fewer than 9 columns to Berlin, one of which compared Khrushchev to Hitler. Another argued that a successful outcome to the crisis was even worth the risk of nuclear war. Alsop also sent Kennedy a personal note with this assurance: "I'm ready to follow your lead." Even though tensions ratcheted up again in mid-August, when the East German government erected a wall physically dividing Berlin, with Soviet and American tanks advancing to either side of the barrier, their guns facing muzzle to muzzle, Post editorials and the Alsop column never once wavered. As Bolin and Thompson had predicted, Khrushchev failed to act on his threat to force the United States and its allies out of Berlin. By late fall, the danger had passed. The crisis was over.
That was The Georgetown Set by Greg Hurkin. Best-selling author of The Inner Circle, The Book of Fate, and 7 other popular thrillers. In addition to his fiction, Brad is frequently on bestseller lists in the nonfiction category for History Decoded, in the advice category for With Heroes for My Son and Heroes for My Daughter, for children's books with I Am Amelia Earhart and I Am Abraham Lincoln, and even comic books for Justice League of America, for which he won the prestigious Eisner Award. He is also the host of Brad Meltzer's Lost History on H2 and Brad Meltzer's Decoded on the History Channel. And he's one of the co-creators of the TV show Jack and Bobby. Raised in Brooklyn and Miami, Brad is a graduate of the University of Michigan and Columbia Law School. He now calls South Florida home. Today we'll speak with Brad about his newest thriller, The President's Shadow. Welcome, Brad. It's a pleasure to have you back with us on The Book Report.
I appreciate it. Always good to be back.
The President's Shadow is book 3 in the Culper Ring series. For listeners who've not read the previous books, what is the Culper Ring?
Yeah, and I will say I always make sure that even if you didn't read the others, you can read this one. And it has a very simple premise, which is years ago I got a call from the Department of Homeland Security asking me to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And my first thought was, if they're calling me, Elaine, we've got bigger problems than anybody thinks, right? But I was honored to be part of this, what they called the Red Cell Program. But I was struck by the fact that they wanted me, a regular, ordinary person. I write fiction for a living. I write thrillers for a living. And I traced it back through history and found out it traced back to a man named George Washington, who had his own secret spy ring made up of regular, ordinary citizens. They weren't military people. They were regular people because in Washington's eyes, no one looks twice at an ordinary person. So I said to my friend in Homeland Security, wouldn't it be cool if you found out that George Washington's spy ring still existed to this very day? And he said to me, what makes you think it doesn't?
Oh.
And that's what the Culper Ring really is, and what this series is really about, is a young archivist in the National Archives, Beecher White, finds out that the president's spy ring still exists, and now he's a part of it, and he gets to fight the great fights for our country. And so each book is just a different adventure, starting with the Inner Circle, then the Fifth Assassin, and now we see the President's Shadow.
Secret societies are front and center in this book. Tell us about the Knights of the Golden Circle.
Yeah, you know, when the book opens up with a very simple premise, which is that the First Lady is in the Rose Garden of the White House, and she's doing some gardening just to clear her head. You know, she's just always stressed and always worried there. And she puts her fingers into the dirt and smells the mulch, and she feels something. And what she feels and finds as she digs it out is a severed arm. And she doesn't know how the arm got there. She doesn't know who got it past security or even the puzzle that's in the closed fist of that arm. But she wants to find out. And what it leads to is, as you said, the Knights of the Golden Circle, who are a real-life secret society that existed years ago during the Civil War, and whose real goal was simply to make sure that they had their own place to keep slavery going. They were a bunch of racists. But there are those who think that the Knights of the Golden Circle are that still around, and that they actually guard the Confederate gold that went missing after the Civil War was over. And I took that real part of history and these great, you know, amazing, great story about these knights, and used that as the villains for the President's Shadow.
Well, I know you do an amazing amount of research before you put pen to paper. I was really shocked to read that in the book you write that right before 9/11, before the planes flew into the World Trade Center, hundreds of Saudi families left the U.S. in the middle of the night. Is that true?
You know, this was one of those ones where the amazing thing about 9/11 is it's almost hard to find real facts anymore. But if you look, you'll see that there are families who did leave before it happened. And that is incredible to me, right? That means that someone knew and someone tipped them off and they left. And for the most part, went unpunished, you know? And I'm just staggered by that. And so you better believe I put that little detail in there as one of the motivations for one of the characters, because anyone who hears that story immediately is disgusted by it.
Tell us about Mount Weather and the State of the Union address. Does this actually happen?
This is true. This is a wild one. So this is, as you'll see in the pages of the book, and again, it's all fiction, but I fill it with real reality. And Mount Weather was this old kind of secret government location that the government stopped using because people found out about it. It's not far from Camp David, not far from in parts of Maryland, not far from the White House. And what happened after 9/11 is that the Department of Homeland Security actually started rebuilding it. And when the State of the Union happens, and some people have heard this part of the story, that all the cabinet members come to the State of the Union. But in case someone, you know, does something awful at the State of the Union, sets off a bomb or, God forbid, something terrible, they always leave one cabinet member behind. The place where they take that cabinet member recently was Mount Weather, the secret government facility. And I love that detail. And you better believe I was like, I got to put that in the book. That's just too good. And in fact, one of the things you'll see in there is we actually even show you one of the places where they take the president at one point in time. On the back of the high-level White House employees, there will be directions to Mount Weather. And I thought, again, that was also incredible. And one of the things that I made sure to do is to include that in there so people can kind of see the fun details around it.
Yeah. Did you happen to track who was missing at this year's State of the Union?
It's actually always public, but you can see very much who it is. I forgot who it was this year, but it's never, you know, that part's the easy part, because you just look who's not there, and you'll sometimes hear the announcers say it, but you don't even realize what they're saying when they're saying it. But there is, you know, there's one that's left behind.
I've heard you can reveal what recent presidents carry in their pockets. What do they carry, and how in the world do you know this?
Now you're seeing my true obsession. So what happened was, one of the groups that helped me with this book was the Secret Service, and they've just been incredibly helpful as I do my research. They've helped me with, I think, half a dozen books now, and I always take their trust very seriously. And as I was touring Secret Service headquarters, two of the members of the Secret Service explained to me that Ronald Reagan used to carry a gun with him when he was president. It was a 38, and he used to hide it in his briefcase and take it on Air Force One. And I was just blown away by that, right? I mean, wait, you're telling me a sitting president is armed? I mean, that's just an unbelievable detail, one I'd never heard before. So one of the people who actually wrote me the greatest fan letter of my whole life was President George H.W. Bush, the senior, the dad. Wrote me a letter years ago and has helped me with a number of my thrillers research. I've gotten letters from Clinton also as well. But I immediately wrote to President Bush and I said, you know, I heard that President Reagan used to carry this gun with him, and I'm now looking to see what you carry with you. It was just one of those fascinating details, like what else do presidents have in their pockets? And I was able to, over the course of the research for the book, I can tell you that Bush 41 used to carry his driver's license. That was it. There was no wallet or anything else. And Clinton used to carry a billfold with just cash and credit cards, pictures of Chelsea and Hillary, and a small prayer that he used to keep in it. Bush Bush, W. Bush, 43, he carried no wallet. He carried a Sharpie, and he also carried the New York Police Department badge of an officer named George Howard, who was a first responder killed in 9/11. And Obama, amazingly, also is of the no wallet theme, like his predecessor. He actually almost has like a junk drawer in his pockets, like a BlackBerry and his journal, and he doesn't have his wallet, but he carries other knickknacks like poker chips or military challenge coins and stuff that people give him.
We're speaking with Brad Meltzer on The Book Report.
Fort Jefferson is a key location in the book. I've actually camped out there, but for those who are unfamiliar with it, tell us about it.
Yeah, though this was also something I didn't even think was real when someone told it to me. And when Abraham Lincoln was famously killed, there were eight people who were considered co-conspirators besides John Wilkes Booth. And four of them were actually hung in Washington. And the other four went to prison. They were supposed to go life in prison. And they all thought they were going, I think, up to Albany in New York, and they were going to come out of their jail cell, and they were going to sail up to Albany. And they were woken up in the middle of the night, and they could see when they were thrown on a boat, and the boat, by the fact that they saw the land on the wrong side of the boat, they realized they weren't going north to New York, they were going south. And they went south, and I mean really south. And some people think that Key West is the southernmost tip of the United States. It's not. There's actually south west of that is a little island, as you've been there, called Fort Jefferson. And Fort Jefferson used to be this fort that was supposed to protect the southernmost parts of the United States, but when military and artillery got so aggressive and so big, they realized a fort can't stop a missile anymore, it can't stop, you know, guns and cannons like that, so it was turned into this private prison in the middle of nowhere. And you can literally sail there today. It's today a national park. You can sleep there. And obviously I changed it in the book a little bit simply because I wanted no one to be there, but I made it so there was a hurricane, and so it's all abandoned. But I love that if you go to Key West, you can take a seaplane or a boat, and you can go to what is really Abraham Lincoln's old brick fort, and it's a fortress that guards the southern tip of the United States, and it's just amazing that it's still there. You can go into the cells of Dr. Mudd and the other men who killed Abraham Lincoln, and it was really this kind of island of transformation that changed these men into something else.
All right. Well, what are you working on now?
So working on the next thriller, which is another thriller, and then what we have coming out after The President's Shadow, as you know, I've done a line of children's books as well, in addition to the thrillers. So The President's Shadow is out, you know, and the following month in July, we do I Am Lucille Ball, and in September we do I Am Helen Keller. And the goal with those books is I really want to build a library of real heroes for my own kids so they would stop looking at reality TV show stars and loudmouth athletes. And so, you know, the goal is so that you can buy for your own nieces and your nephews and your kids and your grandkids these great heroes like Amelia Earhart, like Abraham Lincoln, like Rosa Parks, and in this case, Lucille Ball and Helen Keller. And so that those are the next two books that will be coming out.
And what is the age group of that reader?
You know, we get letters from everyone from newborn babies who they give the gift of a library of these books for them when they get older. But really, it's read by probably 4 and 5 year olds up until I literally just saw my 13-year-old, I should say, reading the Helen Keller book because he was reading it early. He's like, I just love the details in this. So it's really kids of all ages. And, you know, the goal of it, you'll see, is it's never just about them when they're famous. It's about them when they're little. So if I tell my daughter that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, you know, she has no context for that. But if I tell her that when Abraham Lincoln was little, he came upon a group of boys playing with turtles, there's a true story. He was 10 years old, and he loves animals, so he races over to the boys, and he sees they're not playing with the turtles. What they're doing is they're putting hot coals on the backs of the turtles. They're torturing them.
Mm-hmm.
And Abraham Lincoln in that moment has to stand up to these bullies and tell them, take the coal off the turtles. And when you're, you know, 10 years old or 40 years old, sometimes it's hard to do the right thing. And that's what the books are about, is showing you moments where these heroes are just like you and your kids.
That's true. That's why it's such a great read. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brad.
Always good to be back. I appreciate it, Elaine.
Bye now.
And now let's listen to a sample of The President's Shadow, performed by Scott Brick.
Plunging her fingers into the dirt, Shauna took a deep breath, letting the smell of fresh mulch transport her back to those days right after college, when she and the president lived in that little yellow rental house in Michigan, with the bad toilets and the narrow garden that flooded with every rain.
2 weeks after moving in, she got the news that her mother had died. The garden saved her then. She cared for it, and it blossomed. Her matchless burgundy dahlias, which she used to wear in her hair. 3 kinds of tomatoes. When they were running for governor, she dug up 200 tulip bulbs from her mother's garden and planted them in her own. Even when your mother's gone, and your husband's working so hard he only comes home to sleep, you can count on your garden. You plant it, it sprouts, life blooms. That's not some cheap metaphor for life. It's a basis for sanity. Everyone needs something they can count on, a world they can own all themselves. Damn it, the First Lady muttered, down on her knees and tugging with her bare hands on a buried tree root. The root was heading toward her precious bed of English bluebells, set to bloom this spring and perfect for cutting. Even before Orson's presidency started, Shauna had known she'd need a garden. During the campaign, she'd felt the burn that came with the spotlight of public life. And she'd had it all planned. On her very first night in the White House, she had sought out a little patch of land among the flower beds of the Rose Garden. It would be her ground, her sanity. Telling only the Secret Service, she'd slipped outside at 5 in the morning, knelt down in the dark, and planted the seeds of coral bells and morning glories. Many of the seeds came from her grandparents' flower bed by way of her mother's. Shauna had even grown early spring flowers in college, in an inconspicuous patch of ground she commandeered behind the dorm. She'd planted more flowers, even some vegetables, when she and Orson lived in that old rental house, and even later when they were in the governor's mansion. Would she stop now, when she needed it most? Please. She never told reporters she was a gardener or tried to use it for political gain. Somehow that would ruin the purpose. No matter where life took her or what her critics said, they had ripped her apart for gaining weight during the first year of her husband's presidency, the freshman 15 First Lady. Here was the one patch on the entire planet where Shauna Wallace, wife of the president, could run things just the way she wanted to. Gotcha. The First Lady whispered, gripping the buried tree root and pulling hard. God, the cold March dirt felt good, and it smelled so fresh, full of promise. Winter had put so much on hold. She loved getting back to work in the earth. With a sharp tug, the root began to yield, though not by much. Leaning on her left elbow and probing blindly into the dirt, the First Lady felt tunk. Something solid. Not a rock. The root felt weird. Almost soft. Spongy. She turned and pulled a penlight from her toolkit, shining it into the hole and squinting down to see what was in there. Under the dirt, it looked light gray, but as she pulled it closer, it was greenish-blue, with a tint of pink, like skin. A hiccup erupted from her throat. The spongy root had... Those weren't branches. It had fingers. 4 fingers. Squeezed in a fist. An arm. Oh, God. Someone was buried in... Stifling a scream, the First Lady dropped the penlight, which fell into the hole. She jumped back, scrambling, crab-walking away from the pit. The press and early staff would be here any minute. Her body was shaking. Just don't scream.
That was The President's Shadow by Brad Meltzer. From best-selling author Rick Perlstein comes The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. Reviewers are calling this title a dazzling portrait of America on the verge of a nervous breakdown. In January 1973, Richard Nixon announced the end of the Vietnam War and prepared for a triumphant second term. Until televised Watergate hearings revealed his White House as little better than a mafia den. The next president declared upon Nixon's resignation, "Our long national nightmare is over." But then congressional investigators exposed the CIA for assassinating foreign leaders. The collapse of the South Vietnamese government rendered moot the sacrifice of some 58,000 American lives, and our economy was in tatters. Then Ronald Reagan came along and began to invent the new conservative political culture. Against a backdrop of melodrama from the Arab oil embargo to Patty Hearst to the near bankruptcy of America's greatest city, The Invisible Bridge asks the question, what does it mean to believe in America? David DeVries performs the book.
The liberals at the New Republic reflected upon the occasion of the most harrowing 1975 trauma, the military collapse of our ally, South Vietnam. The nation on behalf of which we had expended those thousands of lives and billions of dollars, that, if the bicentennial helps us focus on the contrast between our idealism and our crimes, so much the better. The most ambitious politicians endeavored to speak to this new national mood. An entire class of them, Watergate babies, were swept into Congress in 1975, pledging thoroughgoing reform of America's broken institutions. And nearly alone among ambitious politicians, Ronald Reagan took a different road. Returning to the nation's attention toward the end of his second term as California governor, as pundits began speculating about which Republican might succeed Richard Nixon, and then which ones might succeed his replacement, Gerald Ford, Reagan, whenever he was asked about Watergate, insisted it said nothing important about the American character at all. Asked about Vietnam, he'd say the only dishonor was that America had not expended enough violence, that the greatest immorality is to ask young men to fight or die for my country if it's not a cause we are willing to win. One of the quotes he liked to repeat in those years came from Pope Pius XII. Writing in Collier's magazine in 1945, when the United States was on top of the world, the American people have a genius for great and unselfish deeds. Into the hands of America, God has placed the destiny of an afflicted mankind. When Reagan began getting attention for talking this way, in America's season of melancholy, Washington's touts cited him only to dismiss him. No one who called the Watergate burglars well-meaning individuals committed to the re-election of the president, not criminals at heart, as Reagan had in the spring of 1973, could be taken seriously as a political comer. But a central theme of my previous two books chronicling conservatism's ascendancy in American politics has been the myopia of pundits who so frequently fail to notice the very cultural ground shifting beneath their feet. In fact, at every turn in America's reckoning with its apparent decline, there were always dissenting voices. They said things like, Richard Nixon just couldn't be a bad guy, and that America just couldn't be surrendering its role as God's chosen nation. Not possible. At first, such voices sounded mainly in the interstices of America's political discourse, in letters to the editor, among right-wing institution builders whose industriousness exploiting the cultural confusions of the 1970s was being largely ignored by the guardians of polite opinion, in conservative churches whose pews grew more crowded even as experts insisted religious belief was in radical decline. Christians must accept being a definite minority for the time being, one professor told a reporter for a widely republished Wire story in 1976. But these voices were moving from the margins to the center. This was related to what Ronald Reagan was accomplishing politically. But things shifted independently of him, too. Nation's hunger to feel good erupts in fever of patriotism, ran one Wire service headline about the bicentennial celebration on July 4, 1976. The keynote of articles like this, which were common, was surprise. Surprise that it wasn't so hard to unapologetically celebrate America after all.
That was The Invisible Bridge by Rick Perlstein. In researching this show, I came across a list of top books about Washington, selected by our neighbors across the pond. British readers named George Pelicanos as the author they believe to be the top chronicler of D.C. This author is not yet on my radar, so let's discover him together. In the summer of 1976, the nation's capital was gearing up for the bicentennial. Captain Beefheart's on the 8-track, and the hot new film King Suckerman has everyone talking. Two knockaround guys named Clay and Karis are out looking for trouble when they stumble onto a drug deal gone bad. They end up with a pile of money that isn't theirs. When the well-armed dealer starts spilling blood to get to the cash, Clay and Karis must take a stand, go straight, and get justice. Or maybe just sweet revenge. Carrie Height performs the book.
Anyway, that was Louisiana, and this here was Fayetteville, North Kakalaki. Now, what the f*** was this white boy going to do with that big gun? Cooper watched him walk, strut, really, toward the cinder block bunker. The kid's left hand was cupped at his side, and he kind of swung it on the down step. As the kid passed below the light of the flood lamp, Cooper could see the 4-inch heels on the boy's stacks. Those platforms, the afro, and the kid's street strut. A white boy, wanna be a black boy cracker. He had to walk down, a little too much with the hand action for Cooper's taste, but not bad. And the kid was cooler than a too, the way he went straight through the door without knocking, not even looking around before he did. Cooper wondered, what's going to happen next? It took about a hot minute for him to find out. Cooper heard the muffled report of a long gun come from the projection bunker just as the red-headed phony cop fired his pistol into Fred Williamson on screen. So the kid had timed whatever he had done to go with the gunshots in the film. Maybe he had seen Black Caesar enough times to plan the whole thing out. Or maybe he wasn't into the movie and he just happened to work at the drive-in. Cooper was curious either way. He figured he'd hang back there in the dark a little bit. Wait until the white boy came out. Ask him then. When Bobby Roy Claggett walked into the projection bunker, the fat man didn't even turn around. Couldn't hear the door open and shut, what with the whir of the reels and the flutter of film running through the gate. Claggett stood there, watching the fat man's back, his rounded shoulders, red fireman suspenders over a blue work shirt, holding up a worn pair of jeans hanging flat on a no-frame. Claggett pulled the sawed-off Remington up out of his pant leg by its stock. He racked the pump, pointed the 12-gauge at the fat man.
"You know what this is," said Claggett. "You recognize that sound?"
The fat man turned around at Claggett's voice.
"Bobby Roy," said the fat man, a friendly smile right away, noticing the shotgun, but not showing fear or surprise, not showing Bobby Roy a bit of respect. "Who's covering the concessions?"
"I said you recognize that sound."
"What sound?"
Damn, he hadn't even heard the pump. This wasn't at all like the script he had written up in his head. Claggett went ahead with the dialogue anyway. There wasn't much else he could do.
"That there," said Claggett, "was the sound of your own death."
"Say what?"
The fat man looked Claggett up and down.
"Shoot, son, what y'all doing with that hog's leg? You fixing to take out some crows?"
Claggett looked over at the cot in the corner of the booth, where some sort of needlepoint the fat man had been working on lay on a pillow atop wrinkled sheets. Claggett had known nearly all projectionists to have their own funny hobbies, model car making, non-memorabilia like that, and this one was no different than the rest. Claggett's eyes went along the dust-speckled shaft of light through the rectangular window to the screen. Fred Williamson was crossing Fifth Avenue with the Tiffany presents in his hand. The bogus uniformed cop had begun to close in.
"Go lay down on that cot," said Claggett, "and put that pillow over your face."
"Huh?"
The fat man chuckled. Claggett couldn't believe it. By God, he had actually laughed. Black Caesar bumped into a man in a suit, a decoy for the cop. In another second or two would come the shot.
Why you want me to lay down, Bobby Roy?
Never you mind that now, said Claggett.
He stepped forward, gripped the Remington tight.
Bobby Roy, said the fat man.
And Claggett squeezed the trigger. The fat man flew back, hit the cinder blocks, took down a bulletin board hung there. Claggett pumped the shotgun. It felt good doing that. And watched the fat man kind of flop around for a few seconds like a dry-docked perch. A jagged piece of bone jutted up from the center of the fat man's shredded shoulders. Claggett wondered idly where the man's head had gone.
That was a sampling of King Sucker Man by George Pelicanos. Best-selling author Mark Leibovich is just out with Citizens of the Green Room, a fascinating collection of portraits of Washington's elite and wannabe elites. Hailed by the Washington Post as a master of the political profile, Leibovich has spent his career writing memorable, buzzworthy, and often jaw-dropping features about politicians and other notables. Currently chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, Leibovich punctures the inflated personas of the powerful and reveals the lives, stories, and peculiarities behind the public masks. Joe Barrett narrates.
So far, I've used alienated academic, involved pseudo-hippie, educational and social reformer, and one half of withdrawn simplicity. The letters betrayed an innocently narcissistic remorse over my lost youth. She imagined herself as a little girl, believing that she was the only person in the universe. If she turned around quickly, everyone else would disappear, the young Rodham wrote. I'd play out in the patch of sunlight that broke the density of the elms in front of her house and pretend there were heavenly movie cameras watching my every move. She said that she yearned for all the excitement and discoveries of life without losing the little girl in the sunlight. What happened to that person? We all grow up, theoretically, but not in such an insanely studied way or with such mediation or accumulated mystique and madness that surrounds people who choose this life. The great Richard Ben Cramer wrote his classic mega-profile compendium of six presidential candidates, What It Takes, with the mission of learning not just what it takes for someone to run for president, but also what it takes to even want such a thing. I spoke to Cramer in 2011, about a year before he died entirely too young of lung cancer. He had come to Washington from his home on the eastern shore of Maryland and was holding court for a group of D.C. reporters, most of them much younger than him and me. Even then, near his end, Cramer was marveling at how unnatural the pursuit of running for higher office was for any mortal. The aspiration consumes everything. It also swallows up whole subcultures of people into their aura. Self-appointed big deals in small places like Iowa and New Hampshire, accruing potent hits of self-worth from the attentions of these supernova figures. Cramer talked about watching George Herbert Walker Bush after he had been elected president in 1988 and how exhausting it was just to watch people responding to him.
We've just heard Citizens of the Green Room by Mark Leibovich. Height of the crack epidemic that decimated the streets of D.C., Ruben Castaneda covered the crime beat for the Washington Post. But his apparent success masked a devastating secret. He was a crack addict. Even as he covered the drug-fueled violence that destroyed the city, he was prowling S Street, a 24/7 open-air crack market, during his off hours, looking for his next fix. Castaneda's remarkable S Street Rising is more than a memoir. It's a portrait of a city in crisis. It's the adrenaline-infused story of the street where Castaneda quickly became a regular and where a fledgling church led by a charismatic and streetwise pastor was protected by the local drug kingpin, a dangerous man who followed an old-school code of honor. And it's the story of Castaneda's friendship with an exceptional police homicide commander whose career was derailed when he ran afoul of Mayor Marion Barry and his political cronies. Stephen Bell Davies performs this study of a city engulfed in a bloody epidemic and the corrosive politics of the Barry era.
I should have gotten out of the car already. I should have been working the crowd, scribbling notes on the mayhem while looking for someone to interview. But I couldn't bring myself to get out of my beat-up Ford Escort, pulled up to the curb near the intersection of 5th and O Streets, Northwest. It was the afternoon of December 20th, 1990. I was a 29-year-old night police reporter for the Washington Post. I'd joined the paper 15 months earlier and was anxious to make my mark, willing to do whatever the bosses asked. I routinely raced to combat zones to cover drug crew shootings, even if the trips didn't yield many bylined stories. Single or even double gangster killings were usually relegated to the briefs column. But this assignment was different. 5 kids shot in a drive-by as they were walking home from school just before Christmas. Other Post reporters were at the scene, and chances were good that one of us was going to get our name on the front page. Marked Metropolitan Police Department cruisers, lights flashing, were parked at odd angles in the intersection. 2 TV camera jockeys recorded the aftermath of the attack. A group of spectators was clustered behind the bright yellow crime scene tape, gawking at the bloody clothes and shell casings scattered on the street and sidewalk. Your typical crime scene, in other words, but one that looked as dangerous to me as a sniper's alley. One of those spectators could recognize me, pick me off as I stepped out of the car. For the moment, doing my job wasn't important. Staying safe was. There were men and women of all ages in the crowd, along with some school-age boys and girls. I locked in on the faces of the teenage males and young men. I had to be sure that none of them knew me. Knew about me, that is. The shooting had taken place just 4 blocks from S Street Northwest, where once, sometimes twice a week, I drove my girl Champagne to make crack buys. Champagne was a strawberry, a streetwalker who traded sex for drugs. All the S Street slingers knew Champagne, and all of them knew me and my car, at least by sight. I'd become such a regular customer that some dealers called out, "Hey, amigo," whenever they saw me. Most of the S Street dealers, no doubt, lived in the neighborhood. What if some of them were among the rubberneckers behind the yellow tape? Would they say anything if they saw me approach a cop with my notebook out? Would one of them try to shake me down in exchange for his silence? Would he tell his boss, whoever he was, the dealer who was running the street? If the S Street kingpin found out that one of his loyal customers was a Washington Post reporter, what would he do with that unlikely nugget? Would he use the information as a bargaining chip if the cops tried to take him down? If the story of my tawdry double life leaked, local TV news would be all over it. It could be weirdly ironic enough for the national networks, too. Post executive editor Ben Bradley would probably summon me to his glass-walled office and furiously curse at me before firing me, I imagined. I sighed, disappointed with myself for not having come up with a good, or at least a plausible excuse to dodge the assignment, after an editor had called me at home and asked me to clock in early. I usually thrived at crime scenes. My street instincts were good. Most reporters went straight for whatever police or fire officials happened to be on hand. I worked the edges, talking to the people others overlooked. Civilian witnesses were my priority. I talked to them before they vanished or were scooped up by the cops. I'd usually speak with police later, since they weren't going anywhere. A few months earlier, I'd covered a killing at a blue-collar apartment complex near the Maryland state line. A man had been fatally stabbed inside one of the units.
That was a sampling of S Street Rising by Ruben Castaneda. From Matthew Palmer, a veteran insider with over 20 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, comes Secrets of State, an insightful thriller of global intrigue and behind-the-scenes international politics. Sam Trainor's career of overseas work, coupled with a penchant for being outspoken, has left him on the outside of the competitive Washington establishment. Formerly the top South Asia expert in the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Trainor has moved to the private sector, working as an analyst for a consulting firm. But Sam soon discovers that for all their similarities, the government and their hired contractors have vastly different motives. As he struggles to adjust to a more corporate, profit-driven version of the work, he stumbles across an intelligence anomaly. The transcript of a phone conversation about the fastest ways to upend the delicate political balance keeping India and Pakistan from all-out war. Sam knows the conversation can't have occurred because he is having an affair with one of the alleged participants. As he digs into the source of the misinformation, he realizes that more is at stake than just bad intel. Someone is deliberately twisting the intelligence to stoke the simmering conflict between India and Pakistan. Fred Sanders performs the book.
The Cassandra Project had started at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. When it began to produce results, the enigmatic Mr. Smith had taken over responsibility from DARPA. Perhaps the best word to describe their new paymaster was, somewhat ironically, nondescript. He was a gray man in a gray suit with gray hair that was neither short nor long. Even his skin had a grayish tinge, like that of a chameleon on a concrete wall. According to his business card, Mr. Smith represented a private consulting company called Agilent Industries that had the contract with DARPA to manage the project. Birnbaum had been in and around the Washington establishment for long enough to know that this was Mr. Smith was with one of the various U.S. clandestine intelligence services with their own complex ecologies. And if his name was Smith, then Birnbaum would eat his hat. Whoever he worked for, Smith was able to provide the kind of computing power that made the project possible. Birnbaum did not particularly care if the money for the project came from Agilent Industries or the Central Intelligence Agency. In the end, what did it matter? One of the first things Agilent had done after taking control of the project was to move Cassandra from downtown D.C. to a bland office park off the Dulles Toll Road. This was consistent with the division of spoils among researchers in the metro Washington region. Suburban Maryland, with the National Institutes of Health and a plethora of advanced genetics labs, had a virtual monopoly on the life sciences. Northern Virginia got the death sciences. Birnbaum's research was at the cutting edge of modeling for complex social behaviors. There was no behavior more complex, in his view, than political violence. Complex, however, was not the same thing as unpredictable. The behaviors involved could be disaggregated, expressed as algorithms, and, with enough computing power, modeled. At least that's what Birnbaum had set out to prove. He was starting at the top of the Richter scale, the nightmare scenario. The Cassandra Project was focused exclusively on how different terrorist groups might acquire and utilize one or more nuclear weapons on American soil. "What's Thursday?" Birnbaum asked. "You're demonstrating Cassandra to the board of directors," Smith replied with equanimity. "The full dog and pony." "That's in 3 days. We're not ready," said Dr. Dora Karamanolis, Birnbaum's primary collaborator on the Cassandra Project. She was a computer scientist, and, in addition to designing the hardware, Karamanolis had also developed the programs that modeled Birnbaum's behavioral algorithms. The diminutive Greek was Birnbaum's physical and temperamental opposite. The corpulent Birnbaum tipped the scales at more than 250 pounds. Karamanolis barely broke triple digits and had the delicate bone structure of a bird. Where the political scientist was pugnacious and short-tempered and, he would have been the first to admit, somewhat slovenly, Karamanolis was preternaturally calm and precise, almost to the point at which it would have been considered a disorder. She was enormously proud of her brainchild. Cassandra's existence was classified, but if the project had been stacked against the competition, Karamanolis was confident that the trailer truck-sized Cassandra would be among the five fastest supercomputers on the planet. "You will be ready," Smith said. It was not phrased as encouragement. It was a command. Everything Smith said was a command. Karamanolis shook her head. "The hardware is ready, but we are still having trouble with the graphics software. It's just too much data, even for Cassandra. We could mock something up with stock footage, but otherwise there's no guarantee we can avoid another system freeze."
We have just heard Secrets of State by Matthew Palmer. Readers, it was President Grover Cleveland who said, "A government for the people must depend for its success on the intelligence and interest of the people." With so many political books about to hit the shelves, there's much to grab our interest. I'll do my best to keep you current on the ones that deserve your vote. If you're looking for a special title to spend some of this holiday weekend with, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report. Happy 4th!